Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And sit back, relax, prepare yourself for another voyage into the cultures of consciousness. The scholar of religion, R. Lawrence Moore, once talked about the way that he followed religions, the way that some people follow sports teams. And I have to say that I'm kind of in this boat. And one of my favorite teams are the Mormons. And I know, Mormon Church is very, very problematic politics. They hate gays. They're very reactionary. And in some ways, it's kind of a mass social control operation. I have met numerous ex-Mormons, Jack Mormons, who have explained the situations that they experienced growing up. And how social control is regulated through the church, and particularly through the family, and so I'm not unaware of the dark side of that Mormonism has, as does all religions. Nonetheless, I remain a fan, partly because they, as our guest today is fully aware of, their 19th century origins are absolutely phenomenally, fantastically weird. And, Joseph Smith was a religious genius, perhaps the greatest that our country has ever invented, just in terms of the sheer audacity of vision. And then you get this marvelous contradiction between the fascinating, very hermetic, very magical Masonic, quasi-Masonic origins of the Church of Latter-day Saints, coupled with the fact that these days it's a very bland corporate enterprise. And boning up on the weird esoterica hidden in Mormon lore creates the opportunity for very interesting conversations, such as when you meet these young gentlemen in their suits, in their bland suits, such as they mock in the current Broadway production, The Book of Mormon, which I would really love to see. Actually, turns out that a friend of my family's did the choreography for that show, and so he finally has a big hit after 20 years of slaving away in Broadway. So I'm very happy about The Book of Mormon. But anyway, you meet these guys, these young proselytizers on their mission, and you can go up to them and say, so tell me about Kolob. Kolob being, essentially, solar system. Somewhere in outer space where God lives. And, God was once like us, i.e. a man, and we are going to become God. So in some sense, it's a real physical science fictional place, and yet this idea comes up in the 19th century. So I just can't get enough of that kind of thing. And I've had the opportunity to write about the Mormon Church a few times. I went there on a Wired assignment to Salt Lake City on a Wired assignment, and writing about the databases of the dead and all of the technologies they use to try to keep, store, and process the information, all the genealogical information that they need in order to baptize the dead, only one of their very fascinating ritual practices. And speaking of only one, Mormonism is only one strand of our guest Thomas Metzger's wonderful new book. Tom is a author and poet residing in the burnt over district of Western New York, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that. The ground source, primal scream, the ground zero of so much of American religion, weird and otherwise. And his new book is called Hydrogen, Sleep and Speed, A Verse Tale of Egypt, Rommel, Angry Gods, Caligari, and Amphetamine. And he doesn't even mention the Mormons in there, although the Mormons in there as well. And, you know, so I got this book. I was like, okay, poetry. All right. I like poetry. Okay. And, you know, then I opened it up and I was like, oh my God, it's like a verse novel. It's a set of poems, but it's all telling kind of one interwoven story or meta story. And I just ate it up. I haven't had this much fun reading something in a long time. Beautifully written, funny, very wise, very in control of images, this kind of opening up the sort of resonating mind meld archetypal pinball game of modern esoteric history, fascism, drugs, gods, Egypt. It's really a blast. So I hope people seek it out. I know poetry isn't really high on people's lists these years, but it's a very fun, very rich read. But before I bring Tom on, I want to introduce, of course, our co-host, Maja Daou, the White Witch of Los Angeles. Hey, Maja, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Good. Did you have a? I know I sent you that link late, but did you get a chance to check out some of Mr. Metzger's wonderful poem?
I totally did, and I'm a big poetry fag. You know, I extend way back. I know we've talked about William Blake and stuff like that, but I mean, I'm a huge poetry fan. So I was delighted, you know, to discover when you sent me the link that it was this epic poem. Because, and it was so synchronistic too, because I had just been talking with my coworker about epic poems, because we were talking about Intimations of Immortality by William Wordsworth, you know, and just how, like, epic and super long it is. And then I go to check my email, and then you sent me this epic, super long poem. And like you, I got interested in Mormonism because I found out how related to Hermeticism it is and all those weird little quirky links. And then, like, on the front of Tom's book, there's a quote from the Corpus Hermeticum that I just loved, and I'll just repeat it here for all the listeners. He says, "We do not use words, but sounds full of energy." So
great
good.
Stuff. And yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Blake too, because it's a very Blakean poem in a lot of ways. Talks about Albion. There's a lot of references to Blake, and we
totally.
Were of course talking about Blake a couple of weeks ago. So it's all coming together.
Totally.
So I just want to bring on Tom Metzger. Tom, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Good to be here.
So you're calling especially for you because you are a very place-based imagination machine. Where are you calling from?
I am calling from Rochester, New York, a suburb of Rochester, which is about 20 miles from Ground Zero Mormon high holy sites. I'm not a Mormon, but I've been, when one grows up in this area, the cloud of Mormon influence does float out over the county. So I think over the years, some of it has penetrated my consciousness by osmosis and then eventually by conscious process.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that area the sort of origin story of
sure.
Mormonism, and what intrigues you about this character of Joseph Smith and the world that he was living in, that's, you know, not so far from you spatially, but temporally a little bit longer.
Right. Well, the term burnt over district is sometimes used for this area, which is the western piece of New York State. And people have kind of a skewed view of the state. I'm actually physically closer to Wheeling, West Virginia than I am to Brooklyn. So this is as far east as you can get and be in the west, or vice versa. So it's a corner of a state that doesn't get much notice. But between about 1790 and about 1850, this was a very, very hot place for strange religious ideas and sort of an explosion of strangeness. Beside the Mormons, we've got the Oneida Perfectionists. We have the Rochester Rappings, the beginnings of the spiritualist movement. We have the Anti-Masonic Party. We have the Public and Universal Friend. And the list goes on and on. But it was a very, very fertile period. And Mormonism is the one that's that lived and expanded and exploded, whereas the rest of them have largely withered away. There was even a homeland for Jews that was going to be founded basically above Niagara Falls on Grand Island. So it's a strange outpouring of belief that made it through this section of the country. And my interest in Joseph Smith is it's a mixed bag. Everything you said earlier today about its real strong interest in social control and hyper-normalcy, that's all, of course, true. What I find fascinating is this sort of hyper-bland superstructure above what lurks underneath is quite peculiar and fascinating. So between the Hermeticism and the Masonic ideas, and then just plain old hoodoo, hillbilly hoodoo, which I find quite charming. And there was an economy of money digging, meaning people could make a living with magic implements to find gold and silver. Of course, they never found any, but they could certainly charge for their services. And Joseph Smith started off as a hillbilly hoodoo man who went out and made his living, at least part of his living, looking for gold and silver and pirate treasure, believe it or not, all the way up here. So I find that aspect fascinating, that he's both, he's become hyper-normalized. Even the illustrations of him, his chin has gotten bigger and bigger. He's become more and more of a, in the illustrations, he's become more and more of a normal-looking guy. Early illustrations, he's a bit of a peculiar fellow. So the Mormon influence here, actually just yesterday I was in the public library and there was two of the young men that you were describing with their white shirts and their name tags. They swarm over the area in, swarm is perhaps a bit strong, but they're very much present during the summer when the Hill Cumorah pageant happens, which is the, as far as I know, the largest religious pageant in the Western Hemisphere. Tens of thousands of people descend on the area for a high-kitch, amazing event. So perhaps later on I can tell you a little bit about that if that might be interested.
I definitely want to hear about that. I've always been fascinated with it.
Yeah. I went out there as growing up here, I was not in any way affiliated with Mormonism. However, people know that it's here, and as my family went out, as many ordinary suburban families went out to say, what the heck is that? Back in, this would have been late 60s, and Mark Twain referred to the Book of Mormon as chloroform in print, and the show is kind of chloroform on stage. It's high kitch and quite tiresome. So I went to see it as a child, and then in the late 70s, maybe early 80s, the Mormon Church hired a science fiction writer, Orson Scott Card, to rewrite the script. And I went out to see it with a new science fiction version, and that was more entertaining. And then 2 years ago, I went out with a friend and had I was actually physically ejected from the grounds, which I can tell you about too later. I was taping, recording. I was interviewing some of the proselytes, and the head of security was not happy to have their ideas on the planet Kolob captured on full size series. So I was.
That science fiction thing is totally an amazing part of it too. I mean, Orson Scott Card rewrote the Book of Mormon as a five-part, you know, science fiction space opera that's, right, you know, pretty good, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, and the charm, there's multiple charms, but one is that it really is polytheism. It's sort of a dumbed-down American Hinduism in a strange way. If everyone can become a god, then lots of opportunities present themselves. So I find that both intriguing, and it took me years. I'm in my mid-50s. It took me years to sort of come to peace with the polytheism of them, setup. But I found over the years that it's more and more intriguing. Although I'm sure that if I'm a standard believing doctrinal Mormon were listening, they would probably take issue with the term polytheism or. Well, certainly with Hinduism. Although I have a book I bought just, I was out at, I take various trips out to Palmyra, which is the town where all this happens. And there's a wonderful bookstore there that's everything you could possibly want regarding Mormonism, including a Mormon chess set that looks like it was designed by H.P. Lovecraft, that the enemies of good are all have multiple tentacles coming out of their faces, and they're of course the dark side fighting against the beautiful white side. So layers and layers of crazy. The standard doctrine really is, I've been out there multiple times, and sometimes I go in Mormon drag. I'll dress in my white shirt and shave and clean up and not pretend to be a Mormon, but pretend to be someone they might want to speak with. And there's these wonderful paintings by a guy named Freiberg, and they're sort of like a Frank Frazetta, Conan the Barbarian style illustrations from the Book of Mormon. And last time I was out there, I was admiring one called, there's one called The Waters of Mormon, young woman in a filmy dress coming out of the fountain with the filmy dress adhering very beautifully to her body. And I was admiring that, and the elder came over, and we had a long discussion about the art. And I said, can I ask you, is it really true? I was playing dumb, in effect. I said, is it really true about becoming gods? And he said, absolutely. We will all become gods. So, and on that level, I could enjoy the illustrations and the paintings and the sort of strange combination of hypernormalcy and over-the-top sexuality that also shows up.
Yeah, I love Freiberg. I think that guy is a genius, and I was really happy to discover that my favorite of his paintings is the one that features, you know, Jesus in a kind of, or, you know, the resurrected Christ in a sort of quasi, you know, Aztec, you know, Mesoamerican civilization, you know, panorama with all of these sort of feathered, you know, Indians. And I was extra happy because I went to the Los Angeles temple a number of years ago when I was doing my own kind of local history book on visionary architecture and sites in California. Mm-hmm. And the Los Angeles temple, because of course many of the Mormon temples have remarkable architecture. Yeah. The Los Angeles temple is a sort of mildly Mayan. There was kind of a fetish for Mayan influenced architecture in the Southland for a while, and it has its own little flavor of it, although it's much stronger in the Mexico City temple. Nonetheless, if you go up to the entrance of the temple, of course, which is like just about the place they're going to like kick me out, right, but you could see inside. Right there is the either original or very good reproduction of that particular painting. So they're really imaginally like tapping into that Mesoamerican imagination.
And they really do want to see that whole Mesoamerican phenomena right here in this very tepid New York State landscape. This is not a strikingly beautiful. It's a pleasant place, but it's not in Rocky Mountains and you know, amazing deserts. But the imagination, the Mormon imagination, is grafted Mesoamerican ziggurats, etc., right onto the landscape, imagining massive battles and strange phenomena happening on these small geological phenomena called drumlins, which look a little like whales. This area is the largest collection of drumlins anywhere on the planet. So it's sort of an odd little geological phenomenon. And the Hill Cumorah is just a very small hill. It's, I don't know, five stories high. It's really not a big, towering, you know, beautiful ziggurat into the sky. It's a bland little, a pleasant little hill that's been reimagined, and that's where the Hill Cumorah pageant takes place, right on the hill. And there's an angel Moroni on a statue at the top, and it has a strong vibe there. Lots of families wandering, trying to soak up the magic.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, just even about the imagination and magic of Mormonism, because, I mean, that's one thing that romantically almost has drawn me to them, is that they are just like, their imaginations are crazy. Like, even just that you asked him, like, is it true that we're all gods? And he was just like, yeah, totally. I mean, they have this crazy open-mindedness. And I personally have actually found that to be true in the Mormons that I have personally known. Like, they're just these crazy imagination fiends. Like, and you can look at some of their creative projects. Like, if you look at contemporary youth culture in Mormonism and look at, like, the Aquabats or, like, you know, some of the more crazy youth Mormon phenomenon, mm-hmm. their minds are just open. They're
right.
totally open.
Yeah, and that combined with the hyper-white, hyper-American blandness gives a certain energy. I think that when an esoteric culture embraces everything possible crazy and leaves behind normalcy and vice versa, there's something lacking. But in this case, you've got both ends of the spectrum, which certainly adds, gives it energy, for sure. The pageant is getting a bit hotter and hotter because there's lots and lots of protests now. Anti-Mormon, right-wing fundamentalist Christians are out. Typically, you know, this happens in July. And last time I was there, the county sheriffs are there to kind of keep them, the various parties away from each other. And the Mormons were behaving quite well, but the fundamentalist Christians were shrieking and howling. And my favorite of all time worst T-shirt was a man shrieking at me that I was going to go to hell, and his shirt said, "Ask me why you deserve hell."
This is
not going to make me want to talk to this man. But
you know, I got that. That's funny. You were talking about the way the two sides were behaving, because even though, you know, Mormons are tend to be very can be extremely conservative, and you know, there's this kind of creepy white side of it. Is that they're, in my experience, very often very pleasant people to deal with.
Yeah.
And one of the things about their politics and their level of judgment in contrast to fundamentalists is that they don't have a concept of hell. So
right.
they just have this kind of long purgatory. And
right.
it really makes a difference. It's a real improvement on the Christian algorithm.
That's
because
true.
they're just like, hey, you know, this is our thing. In fact, they think that once we die and we're in some kind of limbo that sucks, when they finally baptize our spirits through the practice of the baptism of the dead, then we'll have the option of joining the Mormon faith from limbo,
mm-hmm.
when presumably it will be very clear that the Mormonism was the right way to go, and it's not too late. So they know we're eventually going to get on their side. So
yeah.
they're just friendlier. It's just
yeah.
much more pleasant than a firestone,
yeah.
you know, brimstone style.
Right, and that's actually the baptism of the dead is one of the ideas that got me so fascinated to work on this book, is that Joseph Smith's older brother Alvin died before the Mormon Church really came together. And Alvin was the one of the oldest brothers in the family, hardworking, basically held the family together for years. But he died by accident, and so once the church became flourishing, there was this whole question about, well, what about Alvin, our lost brother? Where is he? The Christian fundamentalists of the time would have said, well, Alvin's in hell, but Joseph Smith couldn't handle that. So the one of the premises of my narrative is that Alvin, who I call Albion, becomes this secondary god, or his presence looms larger and larger in the narrative, and by the end he's traveling across the country with Erwin Rommel for the end of the world, to go to the place where all the names are kept. But yeah, Alvin, I've been to Alvin's grave, and they've even rewritten the terminology and the names, et cetera, on the gravestone. But there's a certain sadness for them that he couldn't make it, and he really is fundamental in Joseph Smith's rethinking of the notion of heaven and hell, for which we can thank him.
So I know we've been talking for almost half the show now on our mutual Mormon fascination, but to talk, I want to have you talk a little bit more about your book, because it's really a fun read. Have you done other poetry that's in that sort of epic narrative form? I mean, it's not very common to come across that these days, and I thought it was really effective.
Yeah, and most of my books have been novels, 4, 5, 6, I'm looking at 7 or 8 novels, and so I've written standard format novels, some of which are science fictional or quite in the science fictional world, and the way I see this book is, in effect, a big, fat, like a Pynchonian science fiction novel with all the novelistic stuff that I find tiresome now boiled out. So the dialogue that is unbelievable and all the explanations and backstories, I boiled all that out of it and sort of got down to the bare bones. And yes, I've been doing poetry for decades, but never a long piece like this. And I have to admit, I can't think of others currently. There's not a lot of book-length narrative poetry that's certainly not on topics like this. And oddly, the book actually the writing of the book started with Erwin Rommel. It did not start with the Mormons at all. The middle section of the book was actually written first and was based on my fascination with North Africa and particularly the Battle of El Alamein, which was fought entirely on speed, on amphetamines. Hundreds of thousands of hits of speed were brought into Africa for that battle. And so that's where the story began, and then it sort of spun around, and then my local connections here to strange Western New York esoterica linked up. So we have Erwin Rommel, and we have Dr. Caligari, the silent film figure, Cesare, etc. I tend to write in gyres or in spirals instead of in a totally linear fashion, and then when it's done, then I'll straighten it out and make it a little bit more of a linear narrative.
I don't want to like repeat myself again, but it's the way you describe your intention with the poem in contrast to conventional fiction, it just completely worked. I mean, that when I was reflecting on why I was enjoying this so much, it's that, you know, I love the big crazy Pynchonian yarn, but I frankly don't really enjoy reading fiction very much anymore. It seems a little leaden. It kind of there's a lot of machinery, and what I really want at the end of the day, I don't want some character who's, I'm going to, you know, understand their inner life and it's going to reflect my own. I want this sort of, you know, half historical, half imaginal, resonating network of images and events that move between the physical world and actual history and these kind of imaginal levels of orders. And it was like everything that I love about that stuff. Mm. And I got to sit there and read it for 3 hours, and it felt like I went on a whole kind of, you know, exploration. So I thought you were very successful with that. I hope you do more things like that. And also just to talk about the spiral you talk about, this lack, it's not linear in the sense that it's just a story that leads from one thing to another.
Right.
Images recur, history loops around, and yet somehow, and this is true of Pynchon too, or the better Pynchon, that you feel like even though it's a kind of a crazy dreamlike ride, in some ways you're actually getting closer to what history really is.
Right.
You know, how we actually move through time, how historical forces shape us and open up into something that's maybe a little bit more than history as we normally conceive it.
Yeah, when I was an undergrad many years ago, I took a class from Rudy Rucker, who's a science fiction writer and poet and novelist and brilliant mathematician, and he introduced me to Pynchon, and where I started with Gravity's Rainbow, the big 900-pager about World War II, and I felt a bit daunted, and he said, well, think of this as how did you learn history? You didn't learn it in a linear fashion. You learned it in piecemeal, bits and pieces, spiraling back and forth, and he sort of gave me permission to read this big, fat, very daunting and somewhat fractured novel. He gave me in permission, in a way, to read it the way we normally learn, which is in this spiraling, gyring type of pattern.
Hey, Tom, so that music indicates that it's time for our half-hour break, so we'll be right back here on Expanding Mind.
All right. Bye-bye.
Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis and Tom Metzger, author of Hydrogen, Sleep, and Speed, among other things. And before the break, Tom, you're talking about Thomas Pynchon and just that idea of spiraling out and how history works. And, you know, I think about that a lot because I think about, like, that's how even our memory works, not just history. If we can use our memories as a microcosm of that kind of spiral effect, that we remember things in just these little bits and pieces and then, like, can't really come together. And it's almost really like a statement of our existence that we're constantly in these little, like, split-up bits and piecemeal existence. And, like, I mean, even the fact that our scientists can't come up with a unification theory is kind of this big poetic metaphor that really is descriptive of our experience. But so I just think that it's interesting for your writing experience of that poem that it kind of started at a seemingly maybe random spot and then kind of spiraled out to connect with everything. And I think that is interesting. And if you could talk about, like, I mean, what do you think about how you can start at some place as random as Rommel in Africa with Speed, and then eventually, like, just you can zoom out to have it encompass all of that different stuff? I mean, even the fact that you're able to do that within one sample of writing is kind of pretty epic. I mean, that's kind of like what the alchemical process is, right?
Yeah, and I think you're right that I mean, you're recognizing at least that way my mind works, although I suspect not just my mind, but many others work that way. And I was early on what you were talking about, what reminded me of layers of memory. And I think of, we experience sometimes the same event or a similar event, and there's these layers and layers of similarity on top of each other. So I'm looking at an event, for instance, as I'm thinking about Mormons here, I'm thinking about the multiple times I was out at the Hilcomora pageant. I see every time I'm out there through the haze of my memory of all the other times I've been out there. So, and I think that's probably true of everything from as banal as eating your dinner to, you know, the most important events of our lives.
Right.
So, yeah, this, my working method tends to be not so much nonlinear as it expands out from one point, and I tend to look for threads and tend to pull on threads and see what's at the end of it. So, for instance, I did the first book about the invention of the electric chair that came out in the early 90s, and again, that's a Western New York event. That's Auburn Prison in Buffalo and various other places out here. But that started, I was researching a novel called a novel I was working on called Shock Totem, and just on one corner of the novel there was some stuff about electricity, Tesla and Edison and the great AC/DC war. And the more I poked around in that corner, the more I realized there was a story there, but there was also connections there. And it ended up being a book. Similarly, I did the first book about the invention of heroin as a actual medication. And that started off, I thought I would write a one-pager, and it turned into a five-pager, and then I realized that it just kept expanding and expanding outward, and more interesting characters, folks kept showing up in the story. So I kept pulling on the threads and seeing where the knots were, and then following the knots out in different directions. So that's often the way I've worked. And working that way and trying to write coherent narrative is difficult. Poetry tends to give some leeway that a standard linear narrative would not allow. But hey, I'm glad to hear.
Do you think that'll affect how you write in the future? Did you feel like you kind of had like a switch flip or anything?
Well, it clearly has, because I'm already 30,000 words into something new that's been sitting. It's again about this area, and I'm giving myself permission, having seen that Hydrogen Sleep and Speed seems to work and readers seem to be able to respond to it. I've given myself permission now to do another project I've been working on that's not in any way directly related to these themes, but again about place and sort of re-enchantment of place and figures that I've run into, again in this place where I've lived my whole life. I think it's true, and I don't know if this is a function of my age and having read hundreds and hundreds of novels, but after a while, the standard narrative structure really has, I found it less and less engaging. I'm curious, and you said you were talking about Blake a few weeks ago. I didn't hear that show. What was your angle of approach, or what angle were you interested in about Blake that you spoke about last time?
We were talking to Eric Wilson, who's an English professor, but he's written a number of really interesting books that are kind of, you know, sort of post-academic books. Mm-hmm. And he wrote one about Blake and creativity, and it's kind of like, not quite, it's not like a how-to book, but it's a book that's particularly geared towards artists and writers looking at Blake in terms of how the ideals of creativity drove him and how a creative artist sees the world. And it was a very interesting way of, you know, not going into like the mythos or going into the, you know, Blake's role in English literature, mm-hmm. but really looking at him as a creative force, and everything from his, you know, his acceptance of poverty, his mm-hmm. total ambition to just get everything out, to how he worked and what the kind of lessons almost you can get from for living a creative life.
Right, a creative life that was in some ways very limited, certainly by place and by his lack of cash and his political being isolated politically in some ways. Yes, he's been a big inspiration for me to look at. There is a life lived well, and a creative imagination that's astounding in its fertility. And yet, he lived most of his life in a two-bedroom apartment in pretty much the same neighborhood. He did not travel the world physically, but he traveled beyond the world in his mind. And that's been a real inspiration to me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because it's come up a number of different times already. We were talking about the Mormon reimagination of these sort of, you know, rather conventional features of the landscape or unspectacular features of the landscape, and Blake never really leaving home. And I know that you've lived your whole life in that area. Talk a little bit about, like, how you were able to get into place with the depth that you have, because I think it's something that's missing from a lot of modern lives. And a lot of people think it's like, that's over with. We don't locate ourselves in place anymore. We're online, we're traveling, we're moving all the time. And you've kind of moved in the opposite direction, and it's really fed your work and it has, you know, enriched your life. Talk about how you got in that, or how that works for you.
Well, part of it is probably this personality that I probably am, and in some ways a timid person. So I'm not traveling to India or the North Pole to experience, you know, strange shamanic experiences. So given that my circumstances limit me to a fairly small, you know, a couple hundred mile radius, when you combine that with a fairly active imagination, it was almost, I'm guessing, as a child and a teenager, I'm guessing it was almost a survival mechanism for me. The piece I'm working on currently, I've been thinking a great deal about the year 1966 and the year 1971, when important events happened to me as a child and as a teenager, but also in pop culture, pop music, etc. So I've been linking very, very limited or very geographically limited events. I've been linking certain things that happened here and to me to much bigger. For instance, Led Zeppelin No. 4 came out in November of 1971. And I've been focusing very heavily on digging into what was happening exactly then. Led Zeppelin happens to have landed in Rochester the week, two or three weeks before the album came out. The Attica riot was going on. The county prison where my great-grandfather worked for 35 years was torn down that week. So it's, again, this sort of casting the net out and saying, is there any way, what possible connection can there be between an old Scotsman working in a county prison to a big rock band and to the Attica prison riot, which is only, you know, short distance from here. And sometimes the connections are probably absurd, but I think I've allowed myself to make those absurd connections and see what's there. Survival, as in surviving in a culture of that, as you've sort of made reference to, a culture that does not certainly reward imagination or does not encourage the engagement with complicated mental processes. And so this, I'm wondering, and I don't know, if I'd grown up in Ohio or Colorado or California, would I have done the same kind of work? Would I have dug deep into whatever that place was? And I don't know. There are times I think that I would have found the equivalent of Joseph Smith if I had lived in Florida or wherever. America is fairly rich, although this particular part of America is quite rich. And I think it was Mark Twain said that America has a tilt and all the loose pieces, they all roll west. And so they rolled west here in the early 1800s, and by the 1920s, 30s, they'd made it all the way to California, all the loose cannons, etc. So I don't know if I had grown up in Nebraska or someplace where I'm not familiar with a rich esoteric tradition, for instance, in Nebraska. I'm not sure I would have done the same kind of work. So it could be just fortuitous, or it could have been a survival mechanism to keep my mind alive and awake and expanding.
Well, it's certainly true about that area, though. I mean, having done, you know, work on the much larger scale of California, mm-hmm. and just being, you know, kind of struck, the more research I did, the more groups I discovered, the more innovations, the more, you know, mostly in the 20th century, but, you know, some things that are very interesting in the 19th century, and of course some of the interesting 19th century figures came from New York.
Sure.
Thomas Lake Harris is a good example. But you know, when I was looking around, I was just sitting there, I was going, you know, look, really, especially when you talk on the esoteric side of things, there's just not, it's California and New York. I mean, it's just, there's like nobody else is even close in terms of the sheer creativity. And as you point out, in New York, it's a much smaller amount of land. So it is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this recently. I grew up in a suburb that's pronounced Chi-Li. See, it looks like chili. And it's a very silly name, and it's a name that people tend to make fun of. And I was told as a child that the name was named after the country of Chile in South America. But the more I dug, I realized that that's not even the case. It was named after Chileasts, people who believed that the thousand-year reign of Christ was going to happen. And so this silly name is actually linked to this sort of fiery belief in the 100,000-year reign of Christ. But it's entirely vanished from anyone's consciousness, and it's entirely vanished even from most history. Most history now of this area doesn't even get it right. And I've got connections with folks down in Pennsylvania, the various Pietist groups who probably came up here and formed this little enclave, and absolutely nobody knows who they were. And we have a few family names, but they've utterly vanished from the history books. And so I'm one of the few people left that are holding on to that. And I think that's part of actually the imaginative process too, is holding on to what I still have. Now, for instance, I have an aunt who died when she was only 4 years old, and I'm the last person on the planet who goes to her grave and takes care of her grave. And she died long before I was born, and I have all her papers and her. And she died as a small child. And that idea of holding on to those who've gone, I do not have children, and will probably not have children. So that idea of who's holding on to these threads that are kind of floating away, I think that's part of the motivation too of a lot of my work.
You know, I wanted to mention one thing. Well, it was really kind of striking synchronistically. You were talking about the book you're working on now and these sort of network of lateral connections that were happening around the time of Led Zeppelin IV. You got Attica. You got all these things that are happening. You're like, do they relate? Do they not relate? But I think that you're tapping into something really deep about something that we're increasingly missing today, which is not history per se, but a certain contextual quality of history. I was reading a really great essay by the pop critic Simon Reynolds, who we're going to get on the show in a couple of weeks, and his new book is called Retromania. And he was arguing that he's less and less interested in collecting records and more interested in collecting rock magazines. And the reasons he said was that, you know, you can go online and you could find out the history of any given band, like Led Zeppelin.
Sure.
You can go online, you can find out every date that they've played, where they were, when they were in Rochester.
Yep.
You know, you get all that information, but you don't get any of the lateral connections.
Absolutely.
But if you buy the rock mags from 1971, you open it up, you look at the typefaces, you look at the advertisements, you look at the letters, what other things are going on, and you get the sense of this embedded lateral matrix that really is, you know, in a lot of ways that I think we're really sort of struggling to understand how to imagine ourselves into right now.
Well, it's so funny and synchronistic, actually, that you bring that up, Eric, because I was just having a conversation with someone about how, like, zines originated, and, like, a zine, the punkers wrote it to try and capture the experience of the show, and that kind of, like, I mean, you can listen to the music, but having it put in context as the experience of the time is a rare thing, and that's, like, where those music magazines originate. It's kind of like the zinesters trying to capture the experience in a way in print, in type like that, you know?
Yeah. And it's odd that you should mention this, because I actually have I have a big stack of old Cream magazines, and I can read, for instance, Lester Bangs, who I hold in greatly high regard, and I can read his collected works, and they're fun, but to read them in the pages of the Cream magazine that was published in 1971, and when you flip the page, there's an advertisement for any Green Springs wine, and there's an advertisement for lice cream to get rid of head lice, that kind of context, that this is, you can pull out the writing, but without the ads, without the silly captions on the photographs, you do not get the experience. So I'm much a collector of old magazines. I will actually look forward to hearing your interview that you mentioned. That seems like a really wise and also fertile way to pursue it. And the zine scene was very, very important to me in the 80s. I made a lot of connections, and the physicality of those zines and of rock magazines and various other these sort of ephemera, that physicality, I think, is also part of the thing that has fed me to go to physical places and stand exactly where someone stood, excuse me, and to touch physical objects It might seem silly to some, but I do think there's a real power in that physical, even the smell of these magazines makes a difference.
I think you're really right. I mean, when I wrote The Visionary State, you know, and I went around the state looking at all these places and buildings, and, you know, I'd go there physically and I would encounter them. And what I realized, you know, in addition to going through archives, which is, of course, you know, the smells and the tactile and the ephemera that you find, you know, here and there. But that physical movement and that physical engagement gave me so much more information about my purported subject, you know, the history of alternative religion in California, that was really extraordinary. But beyond just giving me more information, it created a different existential relationship where I suddenly felt kind of embedded in a deeper flow, or even having a somewhat more a greater sense of responsibility towards the past, towards history. And what that all in turn gave me was a deeper sense of roots. Yeah. Not roots like I'm stuck somewhere, and California is a very rootless place, so it's this paradox of kind of rooting yourself in this perpetual restless environment. But when I talk to people about the book, and people ask me, like, well, you know, what do you think about it, or what comes out of it? The two things are, one, that, you know, everybody can do this, and not everybody should do it, but if people are interested, even Nebraska, even, you know, wherever, Houston, Texas, where I am now, there are these networks, there are these places, there are these shops, there are these histories, and just learning how where they are is a survival mechanism, kind of psychic survival mechanism. Like Los Angeles is like that. L.A. is, if you just visit there and you don't know anything about it, it's this horrible, empty, strip mall, ugly nowhere. But if you start to learn about, well, these guys lived here and this and that, and tap into local history, you meet other people in the local history, suddenly it becomes a three-dimensional place. It becomes a place you actually, you know, can live. And I really get that sense from your writing, that you've kind of tapped into that way of probing and living in a different way in the place where you are.
Yeah, and I've chosen to live at a slower pace than some people, and I'm speaking to you on a rotary phone, which is probably a fairly rare occasion on your show. I'm an unabashed Luddite, and I think that the benefit of that is that I actually get to have the texture of life sometimes does not escape me. But sometimes if one moves at a slower pace and physically locates oneself, rather than just having electronic simulation of it, it really is a different experience. Like, for instance, just a few months ago, I went to the church where my father was baptized 70 years ago, and I'd never physically been in the spot. And it's this gorgeous cathedral here in town, and it was used to be in a very, very middle-class German neighborhood, German-speaking. The whole thing is German, of course. Now it's all in Spanish. And I had this experience of Spanish Catholicism, very exciting, very hopped up, very beautiful, layered over with all this 19th century German Catholicism, and then actually going forward and taking part in the Catholic ritual. And I'm not even a Catholic, but I thought, I'm here, I'm going to go to the spot where an event happened 70, 80 years ago. It was really moving to have these layers and to have an Irish priest speaking Spanish to me in a German church about 5 miles from where I live. It has fed me, and I think that either it's been an accident or a choice, and it's hard to tell for me which is the case in my life, but I've stayed here my whole life, and my family goes back 150 years in one spot. If I said that to a European, they'd say, "Well, you're a new guy in the town." But in America, 150 years is a long time, unless you're a Boston Brahmin. If you're working class German, they tend to move where the work is.
Oh, I had a question for you. That was one of the other things that came out of my experience of writing California. Mm-hmm. I think the way it changed me the most was that, you know, I hold a lot of sort of esoteric ideas kind of lightly, like I'm not really a believer, but I find it, you know, certainly imaginatively suggestive and occasionally insightful in a deeper way that I don't really know how to resolve. But one thing that really came out of that for me was that I walked away from that project with a much deeper sense of the magic or the shaping power of place. That there's something about the way the geology, the geography, the literal physical shape of the landscape that organizes and suggests and shapes the kinds of human practices and experiences that the literal reality of the ecology and the physical objects in the space shape this human cultural consciousness.
Yeah, I'm absolutely in agreement. I'm convinced that it's the case, and I've known a few people who've moved because Americans are constantly moving. I've had friends who've decided to move back where they came from. And for instance, I had a friend who lived in Rochester for 30 years and decided they had to go back to South Dakota. And there were some nominally job-related things, but ultimately the person said, I want to go home where things feel real. And I've never even been to South Dakota, but I totally respected his desire to go back to the place. And it was not just silly nostalgia. It was not looking for the good old days. And I had an instructor when I was an undergrad decades ago who lived all over the country, and he's now living about two blocks from where he grew up in Washington, D.C. And I say, ask him, what happened? And he said that I didn't feel at home, and not in a sort of sappy Brady Bunch sort of way, but I didn't feel that things were real in all these other places. And so I wonder, as when we're very young, if we develop a sense of this is real, and everything else, if I went to some other place, on some level it would have a different type of reality. And I don't know. But
I think that also ties into, like, what you're talking about now ties into that layer of memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if in your childhood you experienced that reality, then that reality is layered in your memory in such a way that you would only think something is real if it could connect that layers of memory that trace back to that concept of what your home is.
Right.
And sometimes I think it goes even longer than just personal memory. I mean, to bring this all to a very specific reality is that I'm sitting here in my apartment in San Francisco, and I'm about five blocks from the house that my grandmother grew up, which is just not something you normally see in California. I'm a fifth-generation Californian, and my forefathers were in San Francisco in 1848.
Oh.
And it's just, it's like I like you, Tom, I don't have kids, and I relate to my ancestors in a certain way. I have their photographs on my wall, and there's like a deeper memory, maybe it's a DNA memory or something, but where it's not just about like what you were remembering when you were a kid that was real, but sort of proximity to certain traces that are ghosts, that are the ways that others continue to live through us.
Yeah. Yeah, and this area having been...
Oh, wait! The music! That's coming up again. That means we're out of time. And so
right.
I want to thank you, Tom, for joining us. Hydrogen, Sleep, and Speed is a great book. Please listen to it. Thanks for being on the show.
It was a pleasure. Great talking to you.
From me and Maji here on PRN, this is Eric Davis saying, keep your minds open.
Goodbye.